So tonight, title I gave to this talk when I sent out my email was The Paradox of Self, Not Self. This is probably the most difficult of the Buddhist areas of teaching, and also the one that we all in the end have to somehow get. And we start by just by understanding it intellectually and gradually more experientially. And I'm going to talk about that. when I started doing my investigation slash preparation for this, I realized I had so much to say that this is actually part one of this talk, and next week will be part two. So it's a quite an in a deep subject. So, I want to start just by talking about the second noble truth, because this is where this issue first arises, goes so strongly. Remember that the second noble truth basically says, we suffer, we find things unsatisfactory because we cling. We cling to things that we try to make them permanent and absolutely true. We cling to material objects. We cling to ideas and beliefs that we think those must be absolutely true. And most difficultly, we cling to our sense of a separate self. That's the hardest one to understand and to sort of see. But it's something that's always been there. And so I have a variety of things that I want to read. And this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And he's talking about these bonds, these things we cling to. The fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body, which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. Kind of strong words. But this is what he's saying here, is this is the central issue in the Buddhist teachings. When we start digging deeper into the Buddhist teachings, this is the central issue that we have to somehow understand. At the same time, the Buddha also said that there he is sitting under the Bodhi tree the night of his enlightenment, and the last thing he had to let go of was a subtle sense of a separate self. So this isn't like, oh, well, we'll take care of this week sort of stuff. This is something that's, our whole practice for the rest of our life. This is what we have to keep looking at. And he points out also that it's this belief in a self that gets us into all kinds of trouble. We believe in itself, so we have to protect it. We have to protect it because, people are going to be say bad things about me, or they're going to take advantage of me, or so we end up doing all kinds of unwholesome things to protect this sense of self all the time. And on some level, this idea of what's typically is called not self, this idea that a separate self doesn't exist. We can sort of take that in intellectually, if we're open to it. Or as Joseph Goldstein used to say, he says, just if you can't accept the idea, please just try and suspend your disbelief. If you just suspend your disbelief and then let this sort of come to you gradually over time, that we're doing great. And we have to somehow through this practice, start to realize this idea that of not having a separate self, of not self, I suppose you can say, on some deeper experiential level. We have to start at the intellectual level because that's where, how we operate in the world. But at some point we have to experience it. And that's, and a lot of the Buddhist teachings are about how to do that. And I'll get to that point. But before we do that, I have another thing I want to read here. And this is, the note I put here was, why did we bother? Why do we make this such a big deal that, you know, it seems like a lot of trouble to go through, to somehow figure this out, but not figure out to experience this. We have to go through a lot of trouble. And it's certain. And he, this is what he has to say, this really interesting thing. The third characteristic of all existence, which is seen very clearly with the development of insight and awareness, is that in all this flow of phenomena, there's no such thing as I or self or me or mine. It's all impersonal phenomena flowing on, empty phenomena, empty self. There is no entity behind it all who is experiencing it. The experience, or the knower, is itself part of the process. As insight is cultivated through the practice of mindfulness, these characteristics of existence are revealed. Wisdom is the culmination of the spiritual path, which starts with the practice of generosity, moral restraint, and the development of concentration. From that base of purity comes penetrating insight into the nature of mind and body. By being perfectly aware in the moment, all that has been accumulated in our minds begins to surface. All the thoughts and emotions, all the ill will and greed and desire, all the lust, all the love, all the energy, all the confidence and joy, everything that is within our minds begins to be brought to the conscious level. And through the practice of mindfulness, of not clinging, not condemning, not identifying with anything, the mind becomes lighter and freer. Lighter and freer sounds pretty good. This is why. This is why we do this practice. Because and why we have to sort of get this idea, understand this particular idea on an experiential level. Because until we do, we can't get deep into the practice. So the question then becomes, well, how do we keep reinforcing this idea? How do we keep reinforcing this idea that we are a separate self? And the first way, and the most obvious one to see, is we reinforce this by the very language we use and how we use language when it comes to the sense of self. And I've six examples that I've came across that talk about this very issue, this idea that it's the language itself, because language is by its nature dualistic. There's me talking about something, but we do this in a fascinating variety of ways. So for instance, someone asks you the question, how old are you? And you say, I'm 75. Well, that's what I'd say anyway. I'm 75. Or however young you are, old you are. But so what I'm really saying is, this body is 75 years old. But is it? Actually, most of the cells in the body get replaced every 5 years. So maybe this body's only 5 years old. Or it's like, and but it's like we, that I becomes identified with this body. Or we might say, someone might say, what color are your eyes? And we'll say, well, my case, my eyes are blue, indicating that I possess my eyes. So it's not that I am the body, but I possess the body. This is a different intonation of the idea of self, right? And then the same, very same ideas apply to the mind. We will say something like, I am happy. What you're really saying is the current state of mental state that I'm experiencing is happiness. But we say, I am happy. There's a distinct I that's happy. Or we might say, we're talking about the joy, my joy in life. Now I'm possessing that emotional state. I'm possessing that thought process, that mental formation. So once again, well, which one of those is true, right? And then there's the whole idea that somehow I am the observer, that I'm sort of sitting back and watching all of these different body sensations and mental sensations, that this somehow is it accumulates the first four in some sense. Or you might even say that all five of these are true. All of the above. Those are all ways that I think of, when I think of myself as a separate being, as a separate self, all of these are different ways I do that, strictly through language. And this is tricky, because language is like how we function in the world, right? But without language, we're in a lot of trouble. I want to share another tidbit here. And this is a book called Emptiness by Guy Armstrong, who was my teacher for a number of years. And he's talking about this very idea, of course. We found five meanings for I, as the body, the owner of the body, the emotions, the owner of the emotions, and the observer. Which are you really? You might reply, well, I'm all of them. That's number six, right? I'm my body, and it belongs to me. I'm my thoughts and feelings, and they belong to me. And something apart from them, watching it all. And everything you said, all wrapped up in one. Guy, yeah. Then Guy Anderson is a very precise intellectual mind, right? When we've now arrived at the conventional understanding of the self, it's this, in this culture, when we talk about what I am, it's this whole package. This is what we mean by a person, and it's what we mean by I. We've now arrived at a place where, upon looking closely, the absurdity of conventional understanding becomes apparent. How many cells are you? Are you a self as the organs of your liver and also as the emotion of compassion? Are you these the same I or different? Are you a self as your political views and also as your consciousness when hearing a bird call? Are these the same I or different? Are you a self who is changing every moment as the body does with its pulses and respiration and digestion? Or are you an ongoing self who is a stable observer of all these changes? Are these the same I or different? When we look into these questions, what we find are little more than collisions of unexamined language habits around I and my. One is reminded of the famous comment by Ludwig Wittgenstein, famous philosopher, that self is only a shadow cast by grammar. I like that phrase. Self is only a shadow cast by grammar. We have found that these terms useful to distinguish one person from another in social dialogue and to establish social guidelines about possessions. But by not examining the terms closely, we have stretched the idea of self so far that it does not actually make sense. So he's saying two important things here. One is that it's the language itself and how we use the language, either verbally use it or often, because, you know, when we're thinking in terms of language often, you know. Those very habits of speech, of wording, are how we keep creating a sense of a separate self over and over and over again. And we create the sense of a separate self in so many different disparate ways that when you look at them all, they can't be all true. They can't all fit into the same whatever. And so one thing we could try and do, and this is, I've actually played with this a little bit, and some people I know have found this quite useful, is consciously, mindfully, see if we can change this verbal language. So someone says, "How old are you?" You could say, "This body started out 75 years ago." It's a bit klutzy compared to I'm 75, but it's like, it's acknowledging that it's just this body is 75 years old, but there's no one home, and there's no I there. Or this body has blue eyes, or happiness has arisen, as opposed to I am happy. If you can literally take the I, me, mine words out, then we have less chance of reinforcing this idea of a separate self literally many, many times a day. So, and this could be, if you are interested in playing with these sorts of language things, a practice. Like, see if you can spend, I mean, I have a friend who really recommends this. See if you can just spend one day, just one day, not using the words I, me, mine, out loud or in your mind. Just one day. It's really difficult. Because this is so deeply habitual, how we language and function. I suppose even if you're like, oh, I'm not going to go out, I'm not going to talk to anybody, I'm just going to sit here all by myself, your thoughts are going to be full of I, me, mine all the time anyway. So it's like, it's really deeply embedded. Another thing from Guy here. He's talking about this idea of how we can deal with this in some way. Earlier, I described six ways we can identify with parts of our experience as the body, owner of the body, emotions, owner of the emotions, observer, or all of these. We must now ask if these six ways align with four assumptions about the self: continuity, independence, control, and singleness. So these are things we sort of assume make up a self. The body might appear to continue, but close inspection reveals constant change, aging, and eventual death and decay. It lacks independence, and it is built from air, food, and water. It's clearly out of our control. And it is not a single thing, but a collection of a manifold, quite dissimilar parts. Motions have even less continuity than the body, often changing by the hour. They generally arise in response to the immediate situation or a memory, so they are not wholly independent phenomena. Most of us are vulnerable to fear, anger, and jealousy, so we cannot control our emotions. Many different emotions come and go, so there's no singleness here. The owner of the body, the owner of the emotions, and the observer cannot be clearly found. Thus, violating the assumption of stable continuity. Nor is the owner, supposed owner or observer, able to exert the desired control of experience. The owner or observer may feel to be independent and single, but if they cannot be located, we have to conclude that there's no owner or observer there. The self, as the assemblage of all these aspects of body, mind, owner, observer, is the notion most of us carry, but it fails all the assumptions. The assemblage changes moment to moment. It's dependent because it's affected by outside conditions. It's not in our control, and it is not unitary, but many different things. Through this analysis, we see that all our ways of identifying, of defining the I, don't quite make sense. How is it then that we keep having such a firm sense that this I is real? To see how this happens, we can start by looking close to home in the direct moment-to-moment experience of body and mind. In other words, mindfulness, right? So, at this point, I want to point something out, because it's like this whole idea is like, wait a second. And I remember I keep going to, oh, wait a second. And so we have to understand that another thing the Buddha talked about, and what I've been talking about up till now, is what's called absolute reality. In absolute reality, there is no separate self. But in truth, there's actually two kinds of reality, at least, and what the Buddha spoke of, he spoke of these two, what he called relative reality and absolute reality. In terms of absolute reality, there is no separate self. But in terms of relative reality, which is basically where we're living, we don't live and function in the world of absolute reality, or most of the time we don't. We function in the world of relative, of me, not me. And God help us if we didn't, you know. You'd go out into the parking lot and take someone else's car and drive it away because, well, it's not, nothing's mine anyway, right? You know, we need these conventions to be able to function in the world. So we have to remember that. But at the same time, how can we, as we function in the world of relative reality, how can we have a wholesome, skillful way of thinking about me, about what I might mean in within that context? And I have a supposed definition you might want to think about. In the constantly changing flow of physical and mental arisings, I'm a temporary arising, conventionally known as Barry. So it's acknowledging the reality that I'm Barry. You know, this is me over here. But it's also acknowledging at the same time that I'm only Barry in the sense that this is a conventional way to describe that this temporary arising that comes out of this constant flow of constantly changing conditions. It's acknowledging both at the same time as best we can, using once again language, which is imperfect, of course. But it's an interesting idea. In fact, I'm going to read this again because I think this might be some quite useful. In the constantly changing flow of physical and mental arisings, I am a temporary arising, conventionally known as Barry. So it even acknowledges I'm temporary. I am temporary. So it's like right up front. By the way, don't expect this to last. As much as I might like it to, or you might like it to, it's not going to guarantee. It's not going to happen. So this is the how we create this sense of I, and how we can sort of deal with it a little bit in the world of day-to-day life and what we'll call conventional reality or relative reality. But the Buddha actually taught two very distinct teachings that are central to how he was trying to get people to understand this concept through experience, as opposed to just philosophical discussion, which is really all I've been doing up till now. Like, we've been talking about it, but how do we actually, where can we begin to experience this? Well, part of the problem is it's pretty hard to experience a negative, a not self. How do you experience something that by its definition isn't there? So this adds another complication. But in the classical systems of Indian philosophy, and there's this process called neti-neti, which means basically not this, not this. And the idea being, and you see this in non-dual Vedanta and in what's called Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of wisdom. See this idea being used in a lot of different places in Indian traditions. The idea is, if I can't say what it is, if I can't actually put my thumb on it and pin it down because it's not there, or it's all-encompassing, which is the opposite of not there, can I just consciously say it's not this? And if I keep saying, all looking at everything and saying, oh, it's not this, it's not this, in the end, if I can say that, keep saying not this enough, if I can keep going neti 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 neti, then in the end there's nothing left in the Buddhist teachings. You start to see that everything you can look at, everything you can look at, there's no separate self there. And you've looked at everything and there's nothing left. There's nothing left. So it leads you to experience the sense of non-self through this back door, in a sense. This is the idea behind. And so I want to read a little something from the Samyutta Nikaya here. This is so the first of these two that he taught was often called the teachings on the six sense bases. If you're surprised that you have six senses, there's the five physical senses in mind, which isn't, from the Buddhist point of view, just another sense door. And this is what the Buddha had to say. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the all. Listen to that. And what, bhikkhus, is the all? The eye informs, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and tastes, the body and tactile objects, the mind and mental phenomena. This is called the all. If anyone, bhikkhus, should thus speak, having rejected this all, I shall make known another all, that would be a mere empty boast on his part. If he were questioned, he would not be able to reply, and further, he would meet with vexation. For what reason? Because that would not be within his domain. So what he's saying here is that everything we experience, without exception, everything we experience, it's just an arising at one of these six sense doors. And then he says, further on in other parts of the sutta, he says, now look at those things and see if there's any permanent solidity to any of them. Are any of these things arising at any of the sense doors? Do any of them have any permanence at all? And we start going, Oh, that's not permanent. Nope. That was nope, nope. And we after a while we start to realize that nothing we're experiencing is permanent. Nothing. This is where the practice leads, mindfulness practice leads to a place where we're not paying attention to the external details of things, but more to the process that underlies what's going on in practice. And what's all that we end up seeing if we really look closely, all we ever see is something arises, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. And this is what leads us to have some understanding that there's no I there. There's no separate self. There's just this flow of stuff. That's all that's ever there. But let me let Joseph Goldstein say this more clearly. This is from his book, Mindfulness. There's an early insight into the nature of the mind-body process that both comes from this continuity of mindfulness and also strengthens it. It is the understanding through one's own experience that in every moment, knowing and its object arise simultaneously. The knowing and the object arise at the same time. There's the in-breath and the simultaneous knowing of it, the out-breath and the knowing of it. A visual object arises, and in that moment, there is the knowing of it. This is true of every aspect of our experience. This insight is the first doorway into understanding of selflessness, and in the stages of insight, it is called purification of view. We begin to see that everything that we call self is simply this pairwise progression of knowing an object, arising and passing moment after moment. We also see that the knowing in each moment arises due to the impersonal causes and not because of some abiding knower. So we can say that knowing consciousness arises spontaneously when the appropriate causes and conditions are present. Going even deeper, we can see that the knowing faculty is not altered or affected by what is known. And this realization has liberating consequences for both our meditation practice and our lives. In meditation, as we go from painful sensations to pleasant ones, we see that the basic quality of knowing is not altered. It is simply aware of what is arising. One example of the profound consequences of this understanding is the description of Henri Thoreau's last days. He died of tuberculosis at the early age of 44. In a biography of his life, his friends describe his frame of mind. Henry was never affected, never reached by his illness. Very often I heard him tell his visitors that he enjoyed existence as well as ever. He remarked to me that there was as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health. The mind always conforming to the condition of the body. The thought of death, he said, could not begin to trouble him. During his long illness, I never heard a murmur escape him or the slightest wish expressed to remain with us. His perfect contentment was truly wonderful. Some of his more orthodox friends and relatives tried to prepare him for death, but with little satisfaction to themselves. When his Aunt Louisa asked him if he had made his peace with God, he answered, "I did not know that we had ever quarreled, Aunt." It's like, this is, remember I talked about equanimity last week. This is a pretty good description of equanimity as well. So, all that's ever going on, I just want to repeat this because it's important. All that's ever going on is things are arising at the sense doors. They're there for a while and then they're gone. And we build a sense of a separate self by trying to control this process, by thinking we can control it, by by trying to hold on to things, control things, cling to things, push things away. And that creates our sense of self arises out of the idea that we can actually get away with that, that it actually is going to work. Which, if we start to look more closely, it never does. We can't control that flow. But the problem with that thought, I can't control this. Oh my God. That's a scary thought, right? It's like there's this, I'm just gonna be in this flood, and this flood's gonna keep rushing by, and I'm gonna sort of notice stuff. Is it I but I wanna be solid. I wanna be separate. I wanna know who I am. Right. And in another Joseph's books, he talks about this. This is from his book, Insight Meditation. He's talking about this issue in an interesting sort of way. It doesn't take too long to get a beginning sense that appearances arising in consciousness are not self, because when we see how they keep coming and going. A subtle identification can still take place, however, with the knowing faculty itself. I'm the one who's knowing all these changing objects. We might believe the knowing is I, is self, because knowing or consciousness is much more subtle than the other arising objects. We might find it difficult at first to be mindful of it. But just as the mind's power of steadiness, stillness, and clarity grow stronger, we can actually become aware of awareness. Be mindful that you're being aware. At certain stages of meditation practice, it becomes clear that consciousness itself is a changing process. This discovery can be unsettling because for so long we've identified with the faculty of knowing as being most essentially who we are, taking it to be our soul, our self, our center. Now we see that it too, just like all other phenomena, continuously appears and passes away. Imagine yourself dropping out of an airplane and free-falling for the first few minutes. Imagine the sense of exhilaration. But then you realize that you do not have a parachute. So you panic as you fall through space, falling, 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 filled with terror that you do not have a parachute, until at a certain moment arrives when you realize there is no ground. At that point of understanding, you just enjoy the ride. And it's a great image because it's described quite clearly what happens to people. They freak out when this realization starts to bear fruit. It's a very difficult time for a lot of people. And so it's important that we understand this idea that there's nothing to be afraid of here. It might seem scary, but it isn't like when you if you experience these places where self isn't there anymore, you're not going crazy. There's nothing wrong. This is the truth of things, and you're finally seeing, catching maybe a little glimpse. Tiny little glimpse, which is all I've ever done of this. You start to, oh, that's what that is. Okay. He goes on, this is in another section of the same book. And he's describing how another way we sort of create this sense of a separate self. Although a seed will bear a particular fruit, clearly, the seed itself is not the fruit. nor is the seed somehow carried into the fruit. Rather, a process of transformation is happening according to certain laws. The seed grows into a sapling into a tree. The tree bears fruit, and which brings forth new seed. That first seed is not pulled up through the trunk and then deposited in the fruit, miraculously splitting into all those other little seeds. Rather, the seed undergoes a process of transformation due to certain conditions such as sun, rain, and fertile soil. There is no one element that remains static throughout this process. Rather, one thing becomes another, continuously. What actually happens in the great unfolding from seed to fruit to seed again is an unbroken continuum of becoming, of ceaseless change. In fact, these changes are happening so rapidly and so continuously that to isolate any one moment and call it a thing already solidifies too much and renders too static what is so dynamic and transformational. All of the elements of our own mind and body are arising and passing away, changing continuously, transforming in exactly the same way. To say there is no self means that there is no permanent entity that carries over from one part of the life to the next, or even from moment to moment, because it's always changing all the time, which is what he's trying to get us to see when we look at things from the idea of the elements. Of course, I have a little bit of poetry here. This is from Dana Fald's book. I don't think I've ever read this particular poem in any of the teachings I've been doing over the years. It just, everyone's like sort of peruse my poetry books and go, oh, this is just sort of, this is the right one. There's no actual title even for this poem. I return to where I never left. Reconnect with what that from which I was never separate. Remember what has always been true. When I stop the struggle, I expand into unbearable awareness. There is nothing to say, no you to thank, nor me to be grateful, no altar or supplicant, sinner or confessional. When one of us sings, we all recall the music. This is a very poetic way to talk about not self, I think, that we're all connected somehow.